You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Amy Doxer Marcus, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, followed a group of parents and scientists for 6 years. They were seeking to find a treatment for a rare and fatal genetic disease that affects children called Niemann-Pick type C. In the series called Trials, A Desperate Fight to Save Kids and Change Science, she reveals how parents have challenged the medical establishment to speed up research in order to find a treatment more quickly. This collaboration accelerated development of a promising drug and, along the way, pushed the boundaries of medical science. You can find the 10-part series on the Wall Street Journal's website, and we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Amy Doxer Marcus joins us now to talk about it. Hello.
Hello.
You follow the Hempel family throughout this series. What were the first things that they noticed that indicated something might be wrong with their twin daughters?
Well, like many of the parents, the children appear typical at birth, but over time, signs appear that something may be wrong. Often the children are clumsy at first. They fall, they trip, they have difficulty balancing. And eventually parents or even sometimes teachers notice something and tell the parents that they should go to a doctor.
How long did it take to get a proper diagnosis of Niemann-Pick type C?
Well, in the case of the Hempel family, it went relatively quickly in the sense that within, I would say, a year, they got a diagnosis. But for many of the other families that I chronicle in the series, some of them kept going for 4, 5, 6 years until they finally got the proper diagnosis. It's very rare. Doctors don't often see a case like this in their careers.
But since it's genetic, can't you test for it?
You can test for it, but unlike many other genetic diseases where you can take a blood test and it's a relatively simple procedure, in this particular case at that time, you had to do a skin biopsy. So doctors are always reluctant to do such a test until they've ruled out everything else, and that takes time.
How common is this illness?
It's a very rare disease. There's probably only 500 known cases, diagnosed cases in the world, probably around 200 to 300 in the United States.
Are there tests for the genes like the ones for Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis that people can get to see if they might bear a child with a debilitating illness like this, if they know that there have been people in the family who've had it in the past?
Yes, there are some companies that offer carrier testing, but one of the difficulties with many genetic diseases is that there are many mutations on the gene, and oftentimes when you do carrier testing, the tests that are done are for the most common mutations, and if you or your spouse has a rare mutation, you may not show up on the test and yet still have the possibility of bearing a child with a disease.
Now, the twins were named Addison and Cassidy. What was the prognosis for them when they were diagnosed?
Well, it's a fatal disease.
And that's it? And how long were they predicted to live?
Well, it's not easy to predict how long someone's going to live. The children who show symptoms early on often do not make it, you know, out of the teenage years. There are cases of adult onset as well. It's just a disease that primarily strikes children. And so prognosis varies from person to person, a lot depending on what kind of mutation you have, how harsh it is in terms of the rapid advance of the disease.
And what was the standard course of treatment at the time? Was there any treatment?
No, there is no approved treatment. Doctors can treat symptoms as they occur. You know, if you have difficulty breathing or you have seizures, they can give you medicine. But in terms of stopping the course of the disease, there aren't a lot of drugs that can be given. There is a drug that's approved for a different lysosomal storage disease. It's called Zavesca. It hasn't been approved in the United States for Niemann-Pick type C, but many doctors do provide off-label prescriptions for the drug because there is a belief that at least it slows the progression of symptoms.
And has that been more than just promising? Has it actually worked, Zavesca?
Well, it's hard to know. The doctors believe it is working, but when there was an effort made to run a clinical trial to provide concrete data that this was so and get the FDA to approve it for NPC disease, the FDA did not agree to give approval.
Now, I'm assuming that Zavesca was developed to treat something else, because when you have a disease that only affects 500 people, pharmaceuticals are not going to devote much time to coming up with some kind of a treatment. So do people have to rely on drugs that have already been developed to handle other illnesses?
That is often the case with rare diseases. In the case of Niemann-Pick type C, Zavesca was developed for a different disease and now is being used to at least help treat Niemann-Pick type C. But this is the frustration that many people who have rare diseases often express. It's hard when you only have 500 known cases to get pharmaceutical companies interested in making drugs because the economics of it is so prohibitive.
Are there any scientists who are doing research into this illness?
Yes, this illness has attracted a larger group of scientists. This is in part because of money that is raised and distributed by organizations. For instance, there's a very well-known foundation, the Parsegian Foundation, which was started by the family of the Notre Dame football coach,
Ara Parsegian.
Three of four of his grandchildren died from NPC disease, and they've managed to raise $40 million, which they've funneled into developing science and advancing the search for a cure. And so scientists are in this field.
I'm talking with Amy Doxamarcus. She's written a series of articles under the heading Trials, A Desperate Fight to Save Kids and Change Science. And it was in the Wall Street Journal. The Hempels took their daughters to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota to see Dr. Mark Patterson. Is he one of the few experts on Niemann-Pick type C?
He is one of the leading, if not the leading, expert on NPC disease. Many, if not most, of people in the country who have the disease end up going to his office, and he ended up diagnosing many of the children that I followed in my series. He's seen probably the largest number of cases.
And what advice did he give the Hempels?
He gave them a sort of a checklist of things. He suggested that the children start taking Zavesca, and they agreed to do that. He told them about a study that was being done by a doctor, Denny Porter of the NIH, a natural history study where he would examine the children in the study each year, collect data about them, and hopefully when there was a trial, this data would be useful in determining if a drug was working, and they agreed to sign up their girls. And he also told them about a kind of alliance that he and some other scientists and parents were getting together, where they were going to try to combine forces of the experts, the scientists, and the non-experts, the families and parents living with this disease on a daily basis.
The Hempels visited Dr. Christopher Austin, who's the director of the National Institutes of Health's Chemical Genomics Center. What kind of research is he doing? Is he doing any research into Niemann-Pick type C?
Well, yes. Dr. Austin is now the head of an institute at the NIH called NCATS, and this institute is trying to speed up, through partnership and collaboration, the development of drugs for rare diseases. And Dr. Austin's robot lab was screening known compounds that had proven to work in other conditions and trying to see if there might be any hits in these rarer diseases. Because if there's already been some work done on a compound and it proves at least to work in an animal model or in cells in another disease, this can vastly speed up the process of developing a drug.
Is Niemann-Pick type C like other illnesses?
Well, it has some common aspects with other genetic diseases. It is one of a group of around 50 lysosomal storage diseases, and these are diseases where something breaks down in the cell, where the natural recycling process that goes on in the cell isn't functioning, and as a result, fats or other substances, in Niemann-Pick type C, it's cholesterol, build up in the cells, and this eventually causes problems in the organs and leads to severe problems and sometimes deaths in some of these diseases.
Dr. Austin envisioned a better partnership between scientists and people suffering with the disease. What did he hope to change about how scientists work?
Dr. Austin has a very unique background in that he was trained as a basic scientist. He had worked in a lab. He also worked at a drug company, so he knew firsthand the difficulties of making a drug. And he was a practicing neurologist, so he would treat patients that had very difficult diseases like ALS or Huntington's disease. He sort of understood all sides of it. And his idea was that in order to really make science work most efficiently, you need to have patients as part of the team. It can't just be scientists. Even well-meaning, brilliant scientists, even scientists who collaborate effectively, and this isn't always the case, but even with everything going the right way, you still need to bring patients onto the team if you want to really, truly accelerate drug development.
And that's not just the case with Niemann Pick Type C. Some years ago, I was invited to moderate a panel on spinal cord injuries, and they had similar concerns. They felt that all of the researchers were doing their work without really consulting the people who were affected, the people who they were supposedly treating or coming up with treatments for. And they felt that there should be more of a cooperation between the two. I suppose that is true with a lot of illnesses.
I think it is, and I think that's what Dr. Austin was thinking. I think he was looking for some test cases where he could see if some of these ideas could be put into practice, and the scientists and the parents and the families with NPC or studying NPC disease were willing to be one of his test cases.
Can you tell us about the group called SOAR, Support of Accelerated Research?
This was the name of the group that the scientists and the families gave to themselves when they were first starting out. It wasn't meant to be something exclusive, and in fact came to be a kind of umbrella where lots of people ended up joining this effort, some from other groups too in the NPC community. But it was a group that was started with an idea, and the idea was, what would happen if patients, or as they like to call themselves, citizen scientists, worked hand in hand with these professional scientists? What could happen then? Could you go faster? Could you be more effective? One of the questions that comes up a lot, and I'm sure that you encountered this on the panel that you moderated, many times families are much more willing to take on risk in terms of trying experimental therapies than scientists would be willing to do when they think about it in a kind of theoretical way.
Didn't we see that with HIV/AIDS?
Exactly.
Where activists forced the scientists to speed up things and test certain drugs that that they might have done rather slower, but when lives are at stake, they felt that you just had to do it as quickly as possible.
That is one of the tensions that always exists between scientists and patients in general, and it was one of the key tensions in this collaboration as well. Doctors have an obligation not to do harm in their oath, first do no harm. Families feel that when you have a lethal disease and a terminal diagnosis, that you sometimes need to take greater risk. I remember when Dr. Austin, when I was interviewing him about the trial that they eventually set up for a particular compound in these children, he said that one of the reasons why they were willing to embark on a particular strategy in the trial was because the parents told the scientists, this is what we want to do. We're willing to be your partner. We're going to do it. He said if they hadn't said that to them, they might not have been willing to try that particular route of delivering the drug.
Amy Doxamarcus's series, Trials, A Desperate Fight to Save Kids and Change Science, is in the Wall Street Journal. And we have a link to the 10-part series on our website. You go to our show page, you'll find it. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Amy Doxamarcus, whose 10-part series for the Wall Street Journal is called Trials, A Desperate Fight to Save Kids and Change Science. The Hempels began their own research. A lot of people just go to the internet these days, and they started experimenting with something called cyclodextrin. What kind of drug is that?
Well, it's a sugar molecule. It's been used for a long time to help solubilize other drugs. So it's been used in other drugs, but it wasn't believed to have power on its own to do something.
And what led them to think that it might work in this case?
Well, there had been growing interest among the NPC scientists in this compound. They had started studying it in animal models, in mice at first, and then in cats. And as the data started emerging that it was dramatically extending the lives of the animals, the families got very excited about the drug. The scientists wanted to wait, of course. They were very nervous about the idea of taking a drug that was effective in a mouse and trying it in little children. But the Hempels really didn't want to wait, and they were able to convince the FDA to give them permission, a kind of a compassionate use permission, to give the drug experimentally to their daughters. And they started giving the drug to their kids via IV and eventually through other delivery methods as well.
Obviously, when the prognosis is that they'll die if you don't do anything, there is a decent argument for trying something else. But is there resistance in government to allowing this sort of thing?
I think that there's resistance from many different parties. First of all, although there was perhaps some resistance in the government, the FDA did give approval to the family to go ahead and do this. And FDA does do this when there are desperate situations where people are dying and there aren't any other options. But there is reluctance, and you can see why. The doctors pointed out that although this is a fatal illness, someone potentially can live, even if they have a serious case, they could live to 20, the age of 20. If you take an experimental therapy and it doesn't work, you could kill someone right away. They could die right there and then. And on top of that, in this particular case, although the drug was extending the lives of the animals in dramatic fashion, there were two cats that were given this drug who essentially basically dropped dead, the cats. And so this is incredibly scary because you don't want that to happen. You don't want it to happen to an animal, certainly, and you definitely don't want it to happen to these children. And so there was just a lot of fear and nervousness when they started to do this experimentally, even with FDA approval. There was worry that, one, it might harm the girls, or two, that they didn't quite know the right dose yet, that it was a good drug, but that if something bad happened to the girls, they wouldn't get a chance to test the idea and find the right dose.
And then they were giving the girls herbs and vitamins and other supplements as well. So what were the results for Addison and Cassidy?
It's very hard to measure exactly what the results are. Their hearing improved. They seem to have more ability to sort of expressiveness, to sort of relate to their parents, the parents felt. They were taken for regular tests with neurologists, and they scored well on certain tests. But there's no question, the doctors agree, that the disease is progressing in the girls. The compound has not stopped the progression. And this could be for a number of reasons. It could be that they started too late. The drug is most effective in the animals when it's given before prominent symptoms appear. It could be that the drug wasn't getting to their brain where they most needed it in a sufficiently high enough dose. The doctors don't know that yet, but they haven't been adversely affected by the drug either. And that was good because the NIH was able to gather enough data with the scientists and to launch a clinical trial in the hopes of eventually getting FDA to approve cyclodextrin for the treatment of NPC disease if the trial works.
What is the girl's life like? Are they in school? Are they about to live like other children? Or does this disease make normal life impossible for them?
This is a very challenging disease. It's a very, very challenging disease. There are children who have this disease and go to school. and have relatively normal lives. There are other children whose disease is much more advanced, and they may go to school, but they do not have a typical life at school. And there are others like Addison and Cassidy who are not able to go to school. They are not able to talk. They cannot walk without assistance. They don't sing. They don't really have a normal kind of interaction. So that's very, very challenging. It's a disease where it's a progressive neurological disease. You are stripped of normal abilities. You lose your ability to talk and to walk and sometimes to swallow. It's challenging.
I'm talking with Amy Doxer-Marcus. Her series on fighting this rare illness was in the Wall Street Journal. Trials, a Desperate Fight to Save Kids and Change Science. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write about another family, the Morellas. What were their circumstances? Were their kids in as bad shape as Addison and Cassidy?
Well, the Morellas also had two children affected with this disease, and one of them, unfortunately, has passed away. She passed away over the summer.
She was the older one.
She was an older person. She died at the age of 19. They also have a younger child who's a freshman in high school. He's 14, and he also has the disease. But he was able to start taking Zavesca at a very, very young age. He was discovered with the disease before symptoms were showing, and he was found because they already knew that his sister had it, and so they were able to quickly determine that he had it as well. Zavesca has made a tremendous difference in his life. He goes to school. He walks. He runs. He has friends. He has interaction with all of his friends. He has a very, very typical life, and he is also enrolled in the cyclodextrin trial, so there's a lot of optimism.
And the FDA, as we said, eventually approved a trial for cyclodextrin, but it's given directly to the brain?
The cyclodextrin is no longer given directly to the brain. It was. When the trial first began, it was delivered directly to the brain. But that did not work. The catheter that was implanted in the children's brain got infected and had to be removed. So they searched for another easier method of delivery of the drug, and it's now being given in the trial via a spinal tap.
Why would you want to put it directly into the brain, I guess, or the nervous system in general?
Well, there is a sort of a brain barrier that makes it harder for drugs to get to our brain. It's there to protect us. But in this case, when you have a neurological disease, you really do want the drug to get directly to the brain. So the scientists and doctors are trying to find an easier way to do it. If you give it directly to the brain, that's one method. If you can't do that, then a spinal tap allows you to give it into the spinal fluid, which then can go to, which can get past the barrier and get to the brain.
Now, Cassidy and Addison were both given cyclodextrin. Were they given it in the same way?
Yes, they were. They were able to have the same surgery that the children in the NIH trial had as well. But in the case of the Hempel girls, one of the twins had a very sort of serious event occur, which is she ended up getting a brain bleed as a result of the surgery to implant the catheter, and she had to have emergency surgery to remove the catheter from her brain. Both girls continue to get cyclodextrin, but the drug is being delivered via the spinal tap method and not through the brain catheter.
Are parents like the Hempels or the Morellas aware that this could be a problem for them? Do they know about family histories involving this illness?
No. This is not a disease where you have a family history.
It's not like Tay-Sachs?
Well, in order to get this disease, this isn't something like, for instance, breast cancer, where it might run in a family and you'll know that there's a risk because your mom and your aunt, you know, had breast cancer. in this particular kind of disease, this is more like a case like cystic fibrosis, where in order to get this disease, you have to inherit a faulty gene from each of your parents. Your parents aren't affected by the disease. They have one working gene, and that's sufficient for them to be healthy, and they have no idea that they are carriers for this illness. Then they marry, and because each of them has one faulty gene, the children have a risk of inheriting two faulty genes. If they get it, they get the disease.
Well, we see the same sort of thing with sickle cell anemia, don't we, and Tay-Sachs?
Well, Tay-Sachs is a fatal disease as well.
Yeah. So what progress has been made in the time that you were reporting this story? Have there been any notable advances?
Yes. In the course of reporting the story, I mean, when I first met these parents, this was at the very, very beginning of this alliance called SOAR. The parents and the scientists were just starting their meetings. They had a lot of ideas and plans, but they had no idea where this was going to lead them or what was going to happen. Then the scientific papers started getting published that cyclodextrin might be a promising therapy, and more work was being done. And then some of the families started to apply to the FDA for permission to give the drug experimentally, and then a trial started. So we're now at a situation where they started with a concept, just this idea, can we work together to make this go faster? And now they're actually in a trial. There's a clinical trial being run to test this compound. If it works, they'll continue with larger amounts of children, and hopefully if it continues to work like that, they'll get FDA approval, and this drug will become available and become the first approved therapy for NPC disease.
And I'm assuming similar attempts are being made for other rare diseases.
Yes. One of the things that I think all of the people involved in this kind of project were hoping is that this wasn't going to be just something that was going to help people with NPC. They knew that they were part of a wider community. There's 25 million Americans who have some kind of rare disease, and they needed to come up with a model, an innovative model to drive collaboration. They always figured that if it worked for NPC disease, it could work for any number of rare diseases and potentially help transform the way drugs are developed.
Emily Doxer-Marcus's 10-part series on the fight to come up with some kind of a treatment for Niemann-Pick type C called Trials, A Desperate Fight to Save Kids and Change Science, is available on the Wall Street Journal's website, and we have a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org. Amy, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much.